This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Spurs in full cry here.
Welcome, listeners, to The Extra Inch, a bonus episode. My name is Windy, and I hope you're safe and well, listeners, in these troubling times. In a week where the Fighting Cock have made a fantastic podcast about COVID-19 and its very wide-reaching sociological impact, that's for their Patreon subscribers, you might expect The Extra Inch to be doing something similar, perhaps bringing in some data or medical experts to discuss this situation. But no, on this special episode, I'm joined by a puppeteer. Chris, yep. Thatcher, welcome to The Extra Inch.
Hello. Thank you for getting me on. Thank you very much.
Chris, you were a puppeteer on the quite incredible Netflix show, The Dark Crystal: Age of Resistance. But yeah. You've got many other credits to your name too. But I'm very keen to talk to you about Spurs as well, and particularly how you ended up doing what you do. But can we start off by talking about The Dark Crystal, which I absolutely adored?
Well, thanks. I'm glad you liked it. I'd like to act really cool about it and say it was just another job for me, but it wasn't. I think any time that Henson's come calling, you have to pinch yourself, and I certainly did when they asked for this project. I think it's the second time that I've worked with them, the first time being on the Muppets film, The Muppets Most Wanted. So when The Dark Crystal came round, they called me on the day of the auditions. I don't know why it was suddenly done at the last minute, but they called me on the day of the auditions and said, "Are you free?" And of course, you drop everything and say yes. It's quite a trait, actually. It happens quite a lot with actors that you can get castings at the last minute and you just have to drop everything. So that's a shame. But anyway, I was doing some work at the time, and so I had a couple of hours before the audition. So I had to quickly jump on YouTube and find, luckily they had the original film with The Dark Crystal. On YouTube. So, and I had like a couple of hours. So I just binge watched the whole of the film just to remind myself, because it was a film that I loved when I was a kid, and scared the crap out of me as well. as it did a lot of people when they were younger, I think. But, so I had to kind of just get myself back into the zone, before going off to the casting and, meeting the creative team and, trying to do a good job.
So when that all happened, you kind of went along to your audition. Did you have to audition, or did they just give you the job?
Oh no, I had to be cast for it. A lot of the times with the puppeteering, I have been given jobs. If that happens, it's because you've worked with people before and they know your work. But with The Dark Crystal, such a big project, and with it being Netflix, it was with a lot of American puppeteers and core team that kind of had to see what you could do. And it's quite a different thing than, say, The Muppets, because it's more realistic. It's more the Gelflings, the characters within The Dark Crystal, have a more human aspect to them. So you can't be kind of bouncing around going, yay, and doing things like that, like The Muppets in it. So they have to kind of make sure that they know that you can take on that style. And they gave us, the first thing they did was give us a Muppet style puppet to play around with. And once I'd done a little bit with that, and they knew that I was not rubbish, thankfully, they gave me one of the old style Gelflings that had been remodeled, I think, for this particular production. And I put that on, had to do a little bit of script And they kind of, you know, gave me some direction there. And then I did a callback. And the callback, again, was with more Gelflings doing some of the script with other puppeteers, some of which I've worked with before, and basically doing different characters that they'd come up with for the script. And then they would cast it appropriately. There were really a very small amount of parts going, really. And a lot of them had already been allocated to the American core puppeteers that Jim Henson used, people from Sesame Street, people from the Muppets over there. And it was a bit of a long wait, but eventually, yeah, found out that I was going to be part of it and cried.
I bet, yeah. It's just one of those kind of big.
Yeah, it's just one of those big jobs, and you wait around, and I may not get another big job like that for another couple of years, or may never get it again. But just to be part of it, you know, you do pinch yourself, especially when you get on the set and you realise the budget that they have. It's like, it's the same kind of thing as, say, Game of Thrones or whatever. So yeah. You turn up and you just see these huge sets and the huge puppets, which I'm sure we'll get into. And then, of course, they chuck it on your arm and then you get ready to film. And again, you crack yourself again because you just want to make sure you do a good job, you know.
I'd be intrigued if someone hadn't seen the show. I'd be intrigued to see how they'd respond to what you've just described, because it must be quite surreal. So should we sort of talk about what the nature of the show is? I guess the best way to describe it is an epic fantasy, would you say? Sort of.
It's kind of
like a childish thing in a way, but it's made for families and adults as well. And this, as you mentioned, it's got a very creepy undertone to it. And I can imagine, like you, many others were scared of the original film, and certainly this reboot as well. I think it did have a quite dark backstory to it.
Yeah, well, it's the first film, it's the first big project that Jim Henson did when he was still alive that involved just puppets and no humans. So it was a big undertaking. I think it came, it's near the time of Labyrinth, but of course that Labyrinth had, you know, humans in it, but this was just puppets. So getting on the set, it was, basically the story is there's a place called Thra. It's in the world of Thra. And this is a prequel to the original film. So if people are fans of the film, they'll kind of know what the future holds. But it's set in this world of Thra with Gelflings that are in the world. And there are also these creatures called the Skeksis, which are evil creatures and suck the life out of this mystical dark crystal. And I think one of the scariest things about the film, and indeed it is involved within the series as well, is that they find ways of draining the essence, i.e. kind of the life soul, out of creatures to give themselves more life, to keep them immortal. If they don't get this essence, then they end up dying, like one of the characters does in the original film. So it's pretty dark. And I remember from being a kid and watching some of those scenes in the film where the puppets had their life sucked out of them. And it's quite harrowing, but really exciting as an adult to go back into that world and suddenly feel like you're part of it, especially seeing characters like the Skeksis, which are based on a kind of a Jurassic dinosaur and bird-like creature. And they're just hideous.
They are. They really are.
There's one particular one I'll just point out while it's in my head now. I can't remember the exact name of it. I worked on it briefly. And the face of this particular Skeksis is covered in pus. And between scenes, they had to cover slime on its nose and it would just drip off. And one of the particular days, I had the exciting job of this is quite a basic skill that anyone could do, to be honest, but anyway, I was stuck within the Skeksis holding this ball, and as I squeeze the ball, it blows air into the head of this pussed up Skeksis, and it would just gyrate and pulse, and all the slime would drop off. So it was like reliving my childhood fantasy when I had, like, you know, you could buy pots of slime as a kid, or ectoplasm and stuff like that. I was suddenly doing and getting paid at the same time. Amazing. So, that's always been the dream of just basically a child wanting to grow up in the entertainment business, is that you kind of just want to muck about and get paid. And I'm happy to say that during that job, that's what happened. I mean, there's many months, including right now, where there is no job and there is no work. But when you do get it, it's those moments that keep you going as an actor or as a puppeteer to say, yeah, I was doing this at this point. And it's also nice because it's stuck in time. Now it's on Netflix. Your name comes up. You can see the puppet that you're particularly manipulating at the time. And it's something that you can leave behind, you know.
It's such a huge, complex show, and you kind of distilled it it really well there into like the main crux of it. But there's such a lot of characters and lots of characters doing different things in different sets as well. So it's kind of very wide reaching in what they achieved in that show. But I'm interested in kind of hearing about the set itself and the scale of the puppets. So how big are they and are they fitted to you?
Oh, they're not fitted to... I think a few puppets may be slightly fitted to the particular core puppeteers that use them, but essentially no, because what happens is there are particular puppets that will be used by particular puppeteers, but not in every single scene, because if there is one particular puppeteer, a guy called Warwick, who is Hacker the dog on CBBC, so he's involved in a big way in the project, and he takes on quite a few of the puppets. And he'll make sure that if he is taking on a different puppet, a different scene, then he'll have to put on a different... I'm not explaining it properly, but basically each puppet needs to be used by everyone else to make sure that they can do it, if that makes sense. So they can't mold it to anyone. And as far as the scale of the puppets is concerned, the Gelflings are pretty big. I mean, the heads are nearly as big as my head. I'll just send you a photo through. But yeah, so if you hold it up next to your head, they hang down quite far down to below your waist, and they are heavy, and because a lot of them have animatronics in them. So as you're holding them and holding the rods for their arms, you can sometimes hold something that manipulates their eyes, but a lot of the time you have people on remote control offset looking at monitors who will control their blinking and their looks around. And we'll do the mouth movements naturally, but they've got the expressions within their brows and their eyes and their nose.
So I'm assuming then that because they're so large and taking up a lot of physical space, there's no kind of room for much improvisation there. It's probably quite well scripted and you have to follow things to the letter. Is that right?
Yeah. I should go back to your previous question just briefly, because I didn't mention the Skeksis. They're huge. I thought that would be the best answer to your question, which is the Skeksis can fit two people inside them.
Oh, wow.
So you have, if you imagine someone standing inside a huge costume with their arm high in the air, poking up above their head, and that hand goes into a head of the Skeksis, and then you have someone else that goes inside the body and essentially hugs the other puppeteer, and they control the other arm, and inside that actual puppet is a monitor. And so when you're inside the puppet, you can see what the camera's seeing and you can adjust accordingly. But it's pretty disorientating, to be fair. And I mean, I won't go into how technical it is, but when you look at monitors, you have a choice as a puppeteer to see exactly what the camera sees or see it flipped round. Now, it can be a bit easier if you see the camera flip round. But if you see just what the camera sees, if you kind of look left with your puppet on the screen, they'll look right. So you've really got to get used to it, if that makes sense. I hope that made sense. Sorry, what was your last question?
How closely did you have to follow scripts to the letter? Because I imagine there's lots going on at any one time and you need everyone to kind of be in tune with what each other's doing.
I think with this particular project, really, you had to stick to the script. To be fair, most of the characters that I got had minimal script. They would give a lot of the American peoples the full-on script, but they really... If it's a little bit more of a kind of improvisational comedy, maybe Muppets or something, as I just explained, like Hacker the Dog on CBBC, most of their performance is mucking about and improvising. But here, there was so much to think about because they were steady cams. So you had the director, Louis Leterrier, who had a camera attached to him and he'd walk around. So it wouldn't be a fixed camera where you'd be able to look at the monitor and know exactly what you're doing, because the camera was constantly moving. So you had to make sure that your head's not in shot. So there was one particular scene, it was a market scene where I was playing one of the villagers and the camera was going through the market. So if the camera's further away from you, you have to be lower with the puppet. And when it gets closer to you, you have to be higher. And if you get those dimensions wrong, you get seen. And then the shot just goes out the window and they have to do it again. So in answer to your question, there's not that much. I wouldn't say there's that much improvisation as such, because there's so much going on. But there always is a little bit. I think the best improvisation is when something goes wrong, we know it's an outtake, and then everyone goes crazy because they know it's going to go on the outtakes reel. So that's good. And then puppets start singing and jumping around and dancing and falling over.
It sounds like this is like physically quite exhausting to be inside the puppets for that long. Did you have to take breaks in between? I guess they have to give you breaks in between, because your arms can't hold up these things are that long in one go.
You build up a stamina. You build up a stamina and you end up having one right shoulder. That's your right shoulder a lot bigger than your left shoulder. It looks a bit weird. You do build up a stamina, but it is tiring. And they do have to, you know, take breaks at certain times to make sure people, because otherwise people's backs go. They have masseuses on hand as well to make sure, you know, people aren't crippled. Yeah. Usually what you get is, you know, as soon as you cut, the puppets will all hang down, or they have special cushions to place the puppets on. Usually keep your arm in them if you have to. And then the next thing, after a couple of minutes, you'll hear puppet up, and then all the puppets will go up. You're acclimatized, find yourself on the monitor, and then you'll, you know, they'll show action, and then you'll go into it again. There's regular breaks to make sure, but you have to, otherwise people's bodies just wouldn't cope with it, especially with these particular ones. They're particularly heavy, especially for the Skeksis, the ones when you're inside them, because they have belts, they're kind of around your waist. So with certain people that play the Skeksis for a long period of time, and another character called the Landstriders, they had extra rehearsals to make sure they got the physicality right. But also they had what's the word I'm looking for? They had to go to the gym every day. They had a personal trainer. So we turn up about 6 in the morning to start shooting at 7. And sometimes I'd see those people that are playing the Landstriders, and they'd just be coming back from a jog.
Wow.
And I'd be thinking, I've just arrived and it's 6 in the morning, and you're coming back from a jog. So they really did have a tough time.
Yeah, that's pretty grueling.
Yeah, but again, it's one of those things, you just, if you get a job like that, you're just happy to do it. Yeah, it's just, you know, I miss it already.
Yeah, I bet. And do you know if there's going to be a second series?
Well, it don't look like it. It looks like, I mean, you think by now, usually I've heard that with Netflix, there's a certain amount of time they see how it's taken. I think it's been taken very, very, very well, but I thought I would have heard by now. It doesn't look like it, although you think there would be, because although it was very, very costly to do, the puppets are made. Most of the puppets are made some of them cost £20,000 each. So you think that at some point they would, you know, utilize that. Unfortunately, the short answer is I don't know. And of course, I want to know, because I think we filmed for 9 to 12 months, and I didn't do the whole 9 months, but they get you in for a week, or then 2 weeks, or then a couple of days, or then a month. And you know, you just take it, you know, the work as and when, depending on what scenes they're doing. And I'd love there to be a second series, but I you know, can't promise it, unfortunately, which I'm gutted about.
I would love a second series as well. It's one of those shows that not everyone's going to love, but the people that do love it will really love it. I imagine it's got a proper cult following. So if you've not seen it but have seen the film and have good childhood memories of having seen the film, definitely watch the show. It's really, really good. But it's not the only reason you're here, Chris. You're also proper Spurs as well.
Proper Spurs.
So why did it start for you with Spurs? When did you become a Spurs fan?
I was a young child, and I now know that I was surrounded by people within my close family that were Woolwich, and to my dismay, I know. I've since found out as I've grown up, like, oh, okay, they kind of had an affinity. They weren't big Arsenal fans, but I've heard they were, like my granddad and my uncle. But when I was younger, I was had a chat with my step-granddad. His name was Alf Parks, and it gives me great pleasure to put his name out there. And he told me about the great Tottenham Hotspur, and just, you know, told him about the Lily Whites, and went on describing their shirts and the name and their players. And something that really struck with me was the name Hotspur, because it's unique. And when I was younger, like, I think it's being a kind of a kid that wants to be an actor. There's quite a lot of you, you know, want the attention. I think it's that. And I love the fact that there was only one Hotspur. It was unique. It wasn't another Rovers or another United. And I also like the colours. I was into, obviously, being into things like The Dark Crystal or Labyrinth or those kind of things. I was also into Star Wars. Who wasn't as a kid? I was really into Luke Skywalker being into it being white. And, you know, in a white outfit, and Darth Vader, the evil person, being in black, and Spurs on the European nights were all white, and it just, everything just seemed to click. And from that point on, I started following them. And I remember going to my dad's work, and he was an ambulance man at the time. And I'd sit in the green room and just sit and stare at the TV on a Saturday on teletext and just watch. And it would say Tottenham Hotspur 0, Everton 0. And I'd just sit there, and then the screen would flick, and suddenly it would say 1-0, Clive Allen. And then it will go 2-0 Clive Allen, and it will go 3-0 Clive Allen. I bloody love Clive Allen. He was like an absolute hero. It was that about that time that I just remember just thinking, this is amazing. They're fantastic. And Glenn Hoddle was my hero. I feel like I've got so much to say about Spurs that, like, literally you asked me about it and I'm just like, right, I've got license to talk about them. But Glenn Hoddle's goal, though this was slightly before my time, but I saw the videos, was his last goal, I think it was, for Spurs, where he ran through the midfield, through the defence, and then the keeper came out and he just kind of goes to pretend to shoot and then just carries on running and passes into it. It's my favourite goal of all time, and that I was mesmerised by that kind of thing. And that's how it all started, really. And I've got pictures of myself as a kid that my late nan made cakes, and she made me a birthday cake, which was a full pitch with the goals and a football and some football boots with play up Spurs written across it. And got a picture of me in my scarf and sweatbands. And yeah, I've been a Spurs fan ever since.
Wonderful, wonderful. It's amazing. People who don't have like a Spurs link in their family, it's amazing how often the name crops up or the colour of the shirt crops up. But I've not heard it in relation to Luke Skywalker before. That's the first for me. I'm sure there are plenty of others who pick Spurs because of Luke Skywalker. But yeah, it's the first time I've heard that. I love it.
I suppose I didn't even really think about it before, but it is that good and evil thing. I just see it also, like, I've got a real problem with red. And my wife likes wearing red, so that's a slight problem. But like, I've got a real problem with, like, I don't know. I think going back to the Star Wars thing, we were bought little figurines as a kid, and someone bought me one of the kind of the guys that wore red cloaks, and I just hated it. It's just it's one of those things. So yeah, it equates back to Spurs. I love the Spurs. Wonderful.
And what sort of impact have Spurs had on your life and your work?
I mean, the good times and the bad times. I've not had a particularly, I'm not going to go deep about it, I haven't had the best upbringing in my life, but Spurs have given me joy in my life when I've needed it. And also, it's a universal thing about football. It's about family. So, yeah. And if I may say so, your podcast and the Fighting Cock throughout the years, I mean, I don't think people realise it's like having your mates on the end of a phone every day. And that comes from Spurs. So it's quite surreal to be talking to you now. As I said to you briefly when we spoke earlier on, is that I feel like I've spoken to you before, and I have. And that's the amazing thing. And that's what football brings. And of course, it's like, you know, Spurs are like a family. So it's affected my life in many times, up and down times, and brought me a lot of happiness.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
I should, at this point, I'm going to tell you about two things that have happened that are quite funny with Spurs while I remember it, right? So one funny thing that's quite a happy memory is only a couple of seasons ago when Spurs were playing at Wembley, we were playing Southampton, and I think we'd recently been beaten by the Scum, and I was in a mood of, I was in a good mood. I just wanted to pick the fans up. Well, when I say I wanted to pick the fans up, I was just in the mood to cheer and not be down about it. So I was with a friend of mine, and I decided, I was wearing my Tottenham Hotspur bobble hat and a scarf, and it was quite funny because the mood was awful. It was Wembley. It was half empty. Mm. We'd been beaten by our rivals. And just to kind of make my mate laugh, I stood up and I put my scarf above my head and I was like, come on. And I started waving to the fans, saying, come on, get up, you know, just laughing about it, really, because it was just funny. And then a week later, I filmed a commercial in Holland And I was taking a break, and I was just scrolling through my phone. And the next thing, I'm looking at a picture of myself with the scarf above my head on the front page of the Evening Standard.
No way.
It's saying, I think it said, fans livid at being forced to play at Wembley or something like that. And they caught this angle of me as I was cheering, like where it didn't quite look like I was smiling, but I was. But yeah, they chose this picture to say that these fans were furious. But so that was quite a claim to fame that I had mates sending pictures into me saying you're on the front of the Evening Standard. So that's one of my claims of fame to Spurs. And the other one is it is an uplifting end, but when Fabrice Muamba collapsed, I was there on my Todd, as I am quite a lot of the Spurs matches. Well, I was a while ago because I didn't really know that many Spurs fans at the time. I do now, but I was there on my Todd and I was on the front row. I think I was in the East Stand, and obviously saw Fabrice Muamba go down. And of course, I got to sort of see what the rest of the crowd saw, but not what the people at home on the TVs watching from the TV saw. And saw them, you know, giving the kind of life resuscitation and giving them the electric shocks. And it all went, you know, obviously very quiet, and it was awful scenes to see. And obviously we jump forward and we know that obviously he's fine, and that's really fantastic. So the reason I bring this up is because as I left the ground, once the match had been abandoned, and I'm walking down the high road, my phone starts going mental. And I just got like 35 messages. And all of them are just from friends going, you're on Sky Sports. And I'm like, what? So I start streaming Sky Sports. So I looked at it when I got home. I can't quite remember. But basically, as it happened, Sky Sports had decided to scan the crowd and catch their reactions. And I was one of the four or five couples or people that they scanned. And there was an image of me like kind of sitting there looking like death, basically looking awful, like looking scared and worried for Fabrice Muamba. And all my mates are like calling me going, oh, it's amazing you're on Sky Sports. It's hilarious. I'm like, well, it's not really, is it? Because like this awful thing had happened. But it's so fantastic that obviously he's recovered, and I've seen the images of him going back to the lane, the original lane, and just, you know, thinking about it. And although it was an awful time, it's quite touching to know that I was part of that history of Spurs that saw someone he brought back to life, and the crowd singing his name, both Bolton and Spurs fans. And that was one of the times I was there. And affected me quite badly, really, to watch what you thought at the time and the rest of the crowd thinking this guy's just died in front of us.
You mentioned earlier that there's a sort of sense of community and brotherhood that Spurs has given you. And that was one of those nights where I really felt that. I felt like everyone was very... The Spurs crowd handled that situation so, so well and so sensitively. And it really felt like there was a community and everyone was just getting behind him and just wanted him to be okay. And it's lovely that Muamba's maintained a relationship with Spurs throughout the years since then. And I think it must be sort of 8-10 years ago now, I would have thought. That would always stick out in my memory. I was actually watching that match in a pub in High Wycombe. I'd been for a few drinks with a friend during the day, and I was a bit tipsy, I must admit. And I ended up nearly having a fight. I've never had a fight in my life. And I'm not a big guy. And this guy, I was watching it, and obviously what happened with Muamba happened, and this guy was laughing. I just remember this bloke laughing at the screen, like, oh, what's happening here? Classic, typical Spurs or something like that. And I squared up to him. I went up to this bloke and I said, there's a guy lying on the pitch who might be dying. Have some decency. And my mate had to drag me away. And I had to leave the bar. But it was one of those nights where just my emotions were running so high. I think everyone's emotions were running high having seen that. It was difficult.
Yeah, I just think that everyone with football, everyone thinks they've got an opinion and it should be heard at every given point. And in the stands, you can say what you want. But like, there's just certain times when a bit of common sense is needed. And you should have shut the hell up.
So obviously the season is paused at the moment and we don't know what's going to happen. But what have you made of it so far? It's been a real kind of turbulent season with Pochettino leaving and Mourinho coming in. Where do you stand on Pochettino in the final days of his reign?
Oh, it's really difficult. I felt like, talking about Spurs being family again, the ride that like Spurs have given us over the last, you know, 2 years or so, and especially last season, never seen or felt anything like it. I was there at the match when we beat City at White Hart Lane, and I was there for the loss at Ajax and felt I kind of really was part of that journey. And in fact, I was at a Fighting Cock social for the second leg of Ajax, probably one of the best, if not the best, Spurs moment of my life.
Amazing.
And it went absolutely mental. So I really felt like I've heard like Flav say it before on the podcast or you guys say it, but like he's almost like a father figure, Pochettino. And you felt so safe after all these years with him. It felt like it was okay because whatever happened, like we've got this manager who's basically not Tim Sherwood, if you know what I mean. and to suddenly find it change like it has. I don't know how I feel really, and I embarrassingly had about 4 or 5 years where I didn't follow Spurs, and I feel embarrassed to say that on a podcast, and I was hoping not to say it. But when I trained at drama school, I went off for 3 years to train in acting, and most of the people around me were not into football, and I couldn't relate to a lot of them because of that. And in the end, I had no mates to go and watch it with, and I was doing all my studies. So the reason I bring this up is because when I got out of drama school and got into working and just doing my jobs, I remember watching the Japan 2002 World Cup and thinking, why am I not following football as much as I should be? And I went down the pub and I watched that current team. I think it had Tirico in it and Gus Poyet in it. And they were pretty shocking. But there was a relief about the fact that they were crap. And I was like, I don't care how badly they play. I don't care if we lose 5-0. It's my team that I always liked. And I'm ashamed that I didn't follow them for a few years. But actually, now I can get behind them. And the reason I bring that up is because I'm finding it hard to be in that position now because we had so many good years and we were so close to glory. And I think the short answer to the question is I feel like a lot of Spurs fans do now, which is that I think we need to wait into the summer and find out what Mourinho can do with his recruitment and who he can bring in. Because at the moment, with obviously the injuries that we've got, it's very hard to judge. And I remember a while ago thinking, oh God, Eriksen's going to leave. What are we going to do if Eriksen leaves? And then I thought to myself, what if Eriksen leaves and Son gets injured and Kane gets injured? Like the kind of the mainstay, the front three of our team, if they all went, I can't imagine. Well, now we are seeing what would happen without them, which is not a good thing. So all we can do is hope they get back, stay on with us, and that we get some good recruits in, and hopefully Mourinho will do the Spurs way and go attacking like we all like. I mean, again, maybe I'm just a bit an old traditional Spurs fan, but if we go out attacking and go out and die in a blaze of glory, then fine. But I don't want to sit and see him play defensive, you know, and boring football for the sake of it. Although I would like to win a trophy, obviously.
I think that's a very calm and reasonable take, Chris. I think most people would agree that it was very sad the way Pochettino's tenure ended and that Mourinho's been pretty hamstrung since he took over. And it's very easy to sort of just get angry about this current situation and try and blame someone. But actually, sometimes you have to accept that things have happened outside of everyone's control, and it is what it is, and hopefully we'll progress in the summer, like you say. And before I let you go, I'm interested to talk a little bit more about your career, if that's okay. I'd love to find out sort of how you first decided that you wanted to get into acting and also puppeteering, but how did the puppeteering part come about as well? So I don't know if you want to start at the beginning or however.
I'll start at the beginning to get to that point, but I never really knew. I wasn't one of those kind of people that knew from the age of three that they wanted to be a performer and all that kind of stuff. There's none of that really. I just wasn't very good at anything else. And I got to my kind of mid-teens and did some kind of Amdram stuff. And I had a mentor guy, that director that I worked with, and he said, you know, you should go to drama school. And I said, well, that's for kids, isn't it? And he said, no, that's stage school. You should go to drama school for adults and train and go ahead. And so I auditioned and got into one. And then the big challenge was getting the money together, which is another story altogether. But in the end, very briefly, I managed to get some money from the National Lottery, the Kent County Council, and Anthony Hopkins gave me some money, unbelievably.
Oh, wow.
And Victoria Wood gave me some money. I wrote hundreds of letters. Anyway, managed to get some money from them. I'm very grateful for. Went to drama school and then got out and proceeded to try and forge my way in a career of musical theatre, which is what I wanted to do. And I did shows like Grease, the musical, Starlight Express, Avenue Q eventually was a show I did in 2007. Now, Avenue Q is like an adult version of Sesame Street for anyone who's not heard of it. And that was brilliant because it was just anarchic, the kind of thing that I liked, but also was working with puppets and I'd never had any puppet training. So at that point, the company drafted in a guy who'd worked with the Hensons, hence my now link with the Hensons company, and he taught us the basics. And I learned the basics and then did the show for a year in the West End, Avenue Q. And then once it finished, tour came up and I decided to do the tour and I played the part of Trekkie Monster. And he's the monster that sounds like Cookie Monster. So he talked like this, like just like that. And except he's, I don't know if I can say it on the podcast, but he's not interested in cookies. He's interested in porn. So there you go. So it was a crazy character to play, and I played that for like 6 months, and then it finished, and then the tour came up again, and I did it again because I loved it. And so by the time that the last tour finished, I just didn't want to stop puppeteering, but I'd got to this level of puppeteering within it where my skills started getting a bit more than the other people because I'd been doing it for a longer time, not because I felt like I was particularly talented in it, but I think that you really have to practice and practice, and I'd had all this extra time of practicing. So I told the guy who taught me the original skills that I really wanted to be considered to do some more work. And he told me to self-train puppeteering on a TV and film level where you have to start using monitors. So I taught myself and sent him some videos and told him I was serious about it. And then it was him. His name was Nigel Paskett. And he got me in out of the blue to go and do some assistant work on the Muppets Most Wanted. And again, it's another one of the scenarios where you get a call and then you cry. And I got to do characters like Beaker and Dr. Teeth from the band. And my favorite is Pepe the Prawn. And if anyone knows the kind of modern bits, Pepe the Prawn is Spanish prawn. And I got given him, and he's not your normal puppet. He's got a stick inside him with about five different things that move inside it. And they gave it to me. And then I said, okay, rolling. And I crapped myself, but managed to do it anyway. So if you watch The Muppets Most Wanted, there's a scene with Ricky Gervais in a bar where all the Muppets are there. And you can look and Pepe the Prawns is in there doing rhubarb and just chatting away with it. And that's me. And that's my claim to fame.
That was amazing.
So it was a good day when we had like the kind of the first screening of it and stuff. And that's pretty much how I got into the puppeteering. And then since then, I've kind of moved away from musical theatre. I'm trying to do more puppeteering. I do a little online YouTube series with a character called Sloppy, who again sounds just like Trekkie Monster and Cookie Monster put together, but he's for kids. So that's a lot of fun, and take any kind of puppeteering work that I can along the way. Otherwise, the rest of my career is commercials and other bits and bobs.
Nice. So if people are listening and are kind of hearing what you're saying here and thinking, yeah, I'd like to do some of that, where would they start? Where do you recommend people getting into that big old world of showbiz?
Well, I mean, times have changed since I did it when I was younger. I think that if in any kind of walk of life with acting, singing, performing, I believe you need training. And I think I say that because I trained. A lot of people don't train now, and some of the people feel like they don't need to train, and they might be fantastic on screen immediately, but there's certain things within the business, which is etiquette, which people don't kind of, you have to learn along the way, unless you're taught originally. And I think people should train. I really do. So there are various schools out there from 18 upwards. I went to Mountview Theatre School. There's Guildford Arts Ed. That's for musical theatre. As far as puppetry is concerned, I'm not too sure about the puppetry courses because I didn't take one myself. I kind of obviously learned on the job. But nowadays, what with YouTube and all that kind of stuff, all you got to do is pick up a puppet and practice. But there are lots of disciplines with puppeteering, especially with the Muppet kind of style stuff that I do, that do need to be worked at, like lip syncing, to make sure, for example, that as you're talking, the puppet is talking at the same time and not missing syllables, that kind of thing. There is a real skill to it, especially the film and TV stuff, because that's when you're working with monitors. So just the advice simply would be put the work in, but you've got to really want to do it, because the fact is, I may be saying I'm very lucky to have worked on the particular shows I mentioned, but there's months, sometimes years of downtime in between. So you've got to have fingers in pies, in other pies or other lines of work to keep you going, unless you're, you know, one of those very, very lucky chosen few, or you become famous. Not that I want to become famous, but, you know, there's not always work always around the corner. So you've got to have other stuff going on to make sure it can tide you by.
Very sage advice. Chris, it's been an absolute pleasure. And I don't think I've ever spoken to a puppeteer before. So it was a very unusual discussion, but I really appreciate it.
Oh, mate, the pleasure is mine. The pleasure is mine.
Where can people follow your career if they wanted to? Where are the best places to kind of follow you on social media and whatnot?
Well, I'm on Twitter. I'm Chris Thatcher, classic at name. And I'm on Instagram, which is, you can see more sloppy stuff, which is that bizarre character that I did for kids. So that's, I think my Instagram is Thatch 310878. Yeah, get your pens ready for that. For some reason, I thought it would be cool to put my birth date in my Instagram name. What a pillock. So I don't know why I did that. But otherwise, I've got a website, which is christhatcher.co.uk. The Dark Crystal's on Netflix, still streaming right now. And that's not even about me, really. The actual project itself is, you know, it's just so, it's so fantastic, and so much money's been ploughed into it. So, get it on Netflix, especially in these times. If people have got a lot more downtime, which I certainly have at the moment, then that's a series to look at.
Definitely. It's one to binge while we're all self-isolating. Yeah. Chris, thank you ever so much for your time. Very much appreciated.
It's my pleasure. And come on, you Spurs.
You've been listening to The Extra Inch. Thanks to Nathan A. Clark for production. Thanks to Barney for being Italian. Thanks to Adam Gardner for the artwork. Thanks to David Lindner for our intro music. You can find him on Twitter at @DavyShambles and his SoundCloud, D. Lindner. Do check him out. He's great. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at The Extra Inch. Email us via podcast@theextrainch.co.uk and subscribe via your usual podcast platforms. And if you do enjoy the podcast, consider leaving us a rating and review. That would really help.
Okay, I have two new obsessions that I need to share with you. Impress No Glue Press-On Manis and Impress Press-On Falsies Lashes. Trust me, these are getting ready game changers. Both require no glue, so there is no damage to your natural nails and lashes, no mess, and no annoying dry times. Just one step and you're done. Boom. Instant glam. Visit impressbeauty.com/presson and use code PRESSON25 at checkout for 25% off Impress manicure and Press-On falsies.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.